The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
I am your future.
Isn't it about time for a change?
We're our national leaders.
AmericanWorkersRadio.com. You're listening to American Workers Radio, a national network promoting American-made products with your host, Michael Blihash.
Well, welcome once again to another edition of American Workers Radio, broadcasting here on 860 AM, serving the Philadelphia and tri-state area, and you're asked to contact family and friends, invite them to tune in here on 860, and if they live outside the area of Philadelphia and the tri-state, invite them to tune in live by going to AmericanWorkersRadio.com and click on the Listen Live link. However, you can listen to rebroadcast 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, simply by logging on to AmericanWorkersRadio.com and click on the Listen Anytime link. Well, as you know, I can't believe it's already the last Wednesday of May. Where is this time going? I can't figure it out. But that's the way it is, and that's the way it's going to be, because, as we say so often, the clock only goes in one direction. I'd like to take this opportunity to mention our panel members, Mark Andel, founder of the Made in America store, Larkin Conley, national business advocate, Rich Logis, the principal of RJL Technology Integration, and our engineer, Henry Chaplinsky. I'm Michael Blihash. And as you know, this has been a very, very unusual year. First, I would like to say thanks to our great guest from last week, Tom Heffron, founder and CEO of Think Furniture, who was our guest on last Wednesday's broadcast. Tom was absolutely the greatest. He is wonderful to talk to deal with, and just to hear his message about American Workers Radio. You can hear a rebroadcast of last week's broadcast simply by logging on to AmericanWorkersRadio.com and click on the Listen Anytime link. And I'd like to take this opportunity to pause to remember the unfortunate murder of 19 children and two adults in the schools in Texas. Wow, what a very disappointing situation. It's another date, Tuesday, May the 25th at 11:32 a.m. was another unfortunate day in American history, and we offer our condolences to the family all the families and everyone involved with taking care of grandparents, aunts, uncles, everyone involved with this loss. The heartbreak has been unbelievable to witness, and all of us who have children and grandchildren certainly understand how unbelievable this has touched all of us. Well, ladies and gentlemen, today we're going to address a lot of issues, and to help us do that, I have a special guest from the Pennsylvania State Legislature. He's a House of Representative member, Joe Hohenstein, from the 177th District, which covers a large portion of the area where our listeners and constituents live in northeast section of Philadelphia. However, Joe is well known for other activities prior to entering the legislature, and we'll talk a little bit about that too. Joe represents a particular geographic district in the Philadelphia area, but we are going to focus on discussions that are directed to more American workers and our fellow Americans throughout the United States, because that's really what it's all about. How are we going to help one another? What we do in Pennsylvania could encourage someone in 10 or 15 other states to take action on promoting jobs, getting industries back. I worked with Joe Hohenstein for several years. And Joe, I'm going to ask you to say hello and to tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, Michael. I'm, as you said, I'm Joe Hohenstein, and I appreciate your pronouncing the name correctly. but I am in the legislature here in Harrisburg. I'm calling you from Harrisburg and proud to be representing the district, the 177th district, in my second term now. And for 25 years before that, I was an immigration attorney, so I handled a lot of cases, principally for people facing deportation, but I also did handle some business and employment cases, and I had a special project that I worked on in one of the nonprofits where I was that helped victims of domestic violence and securing their rights as well. The other thing to know about me is my family goes back in the neighborhoods where I live, which is Frankfurt, really 5 generations. My great-great-grandfather came over from Germany. I've got heritage in from Ireland and from Hungary as well. So the idea that I have about how immigration works is kind of connected to that idea that when you come and you buy into the American dream, you should be able to find the resources and support that will help you to achieve the dream. And I think a lot of our neighborhoods, you know, you and I talk about this a lot, really are those folks who have both pulled themselves up, but also there's been some benefit from being in a place like the United States where opportunity is rewarded and supported so that we can always be making lives better for our kids and grandkids, and that's something that I really try to approach the work that I do in Harrisburg with that type of spirit in mind.
Well, Joe, I want to tell the listeners that Joe has been a great supporter of the community, or even our agency that serves the people in the 5-county area. And I always can depend on Joe offering a good side of an answer. You know, he tries not to bibble babble his way through the system. You know, Joe, all of us know Americans are living with out of control inflation. Some of that has happened as a result of the gas situation in America and the issue where so many of the items that were being imported were delayed in coming in. But the gas situation has really hurt us very, very deeply. And I'd like to see that addressed as we continue in the next few weeks. I know that there's going to be a lot of proposals on the table because, as it was announced in 6 months ago, I announced probably on our broadcast a year ago, there are only 1% of the cars in the world able to accept electric, you know, batteries at this time. So we have 99% of the automobiles and trucks and everything else that we have to look to get that fuel in them without being charged double as we have been in the last 16 months. We have to do something about it. Now, I know, Joe, that you are going to be dealing with your committees, and I appreciate you taking the time to make sure you let everyone know that it's important to make sure that the people in Harrisburg know how important our community organizations are. You and I talk about some of the unfortunate situations of many families being in need. We have a lot of parents living in the city, and their children and grandchildren live several states away. So at least having contact with places like Passanal has been very, very valuable. Now, there's one big thing I would like to ask you today. And before I do that, I want to introduce you to one of our panel members. And his name is Rich Logis. He has to go first because he has an obligation today. Rich, welcome our special guest, Rich.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Joe. Rich Logis here from the state of Florida. And thank you for coming on. And I spent some time to look at your social media this morning, and I want to say I really like a lot of what I saw. My wife is from Poland. She's a naturalized citizen and voted for the first time in 2016. So the question I have for you, I'm going to preface with, it's an unfair question. So let me just get it out of the way. It's not a fair question to you, but I'm still going to ask it. Why do so many of your colleagues across the aisle still say that Donald Trump won the presidential election in 2020? Why?
I honestly don't know why, you know, what their motivation necessarily would be. I do know that one of the things that's ironic in that is that they cite the changes in Pennsylvania in particular with our voting laws, and those were changes I actually voted against because I was concerned about the transition period for mail-in votes and whether that could be done, you know, in time for the election in 2020. I was pleasantly surprised that it could be, but I didn't think it would be when I voted. But the other party actually voted unanimously. I don't know that there was a single Republican vote against those changes. So a lot of the changes that they cite to in our election law are exactly the ones that they themselves voted for and wanted to put in place. So that that part, you know, it puzzles me, and I don't know that I can really talk to what, you know, their motivations are for saying that, you know, a particular person didn't win the election when, you know, all of the impartial folks and the people reviewing really you know, confirm that yes, it, you know, that the result is the fair and accurate one. One last thing I just want to mention with this, because it's something that concerns me, both as an elected official and also somebody who, on the neighborhood level, is really engaged with the political process. Like, I serve as a committee person, and I know that the people who serve on our election boards and you know, my wife is you know, judge of elections in our local polling place, but I've also got a number of friends from both sides of the political aisle who in their own neighborhood do this service to be the election workers. And so the questioning of the election is really, to me, it feels sometimes like they're questioning their own neighbors. And that concerns me, because I don't think that's good for us as a society as a whole. And I think that, you know, we have to, in Philadelphia, we say trust the process for a different reason, you know, relating to our sports teams. But we do have to trust that our, you know, processes for the election, when they're tested and when everybody, you know, really does sit back and look at what the final results are, our processes are as strong as they've ever been. But we also need to make sure that the confidence is there. Because if you don't have confidence in a process, it can, no matter how good it is, it can still be eroded. And that's my concern, I think, when we have these conversations of, you know, who won an election or who didn't. So,
Joe, thank you for answering. And that unfair question went so well, I figured let me bring another one up to you.
Okay.
And I'm a Celtics fan, so we won't hold that against each other here. Okay, even though I'm from New York, I could always relate to the big unathletic white guy, so I became a Larry Bird, Kevin McHale Celtics fan. But I got a lot of respect for the Sixers and their history. You know, 82-83 Sixers, one of the greatest teams of all time in basketball.
That's what I grew up on. Yep.
Yeah, those guys.
I also grew up on some of the other epic battles too. I think there was one in 81 where Celtics came back from 3-1 and beat us.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that one up. That's one. That's a favorite one of mine. So I appreciate bringing that up. But you guys got us back though. You got us back. So you know it evened out somewhat in the end. When I talk to younger people in sales trainings, one of the principles I always bring up is that a leader will always be honest, even at the risk of losing money in relationships. And in the case of an elected official, will always be honest, even at the risk of losing votes. So the second unfair question I have is, for your colleagues on the other side of the aisle who continue to say that Donald Trump won the presidential election, do you think that they really believe that, though? I mean, do they lie to Texas and ask them, did Trump win the election? Do you think it would show yes? Do you think that they really believe that? I mean, in their heart and soul, right? I'm asking you an unfair question.
I can't speak for all of them. I have had some of these conversations with a few folks who, you know, signed off on letters or have made statements, and some. Not all, but some of the folks that I've spoken to in private will acknowledge that they recognize Biden won. But again, that to me is one of the problems that we have when we get too much on this, you know, polarized, and it's less about politics and more about personality, because I think in particular when you talk about Donald Trump, you're talking about someone who has come to embody certain things that that people want to believe in, but he is not actually an example of the things that they believe in, and that's a problem. So that causes this difference between what somebody might say publicly about it, because again, as you said, they might be afraid of losing votes, and then acknowledge in private.
No, Joe, that was
Michael, if I may, and Joe, I just full disclosure here, because I believe in transparency, and if anyone who listens to the show for a while knows this, I voted for President Trump twice. I worked on his campaign. I sent money to his campaign buying merchandise.
Okay.
But by the end of all of this, what I think that President Trump has done is I think that he has irreversibly adulterated the integrity of the presidency, because the presidency does not belong to a single man or woman. The presidency belongs to the people. This is exactly what Vice President Pence said a few months ago. So even if I sat down with you, Joe, and we talked, I bet we could work on some issues together and then on some others, we'd probably agree to disagree. But those people you talked about who in private acknowledge what the outcomes were but don't say it publicly, and I'm not asking you to name names. That's not what I'm asking. But what I'm saying is those are individuals who are not leaders. They are not leaders, because a leader will always be honest, even if we agree to disagree. So I appreciate Joe answering those two unfair questions. Thank you.
You know, Rich, I want to say this. What you said is very good. No individual should be thinking that they are representing the whole country. That's not good. They're there to be a leader, to be a uniting force. And that's something that we have to look forward to in the future, to look real close at every person running for every office to see if they are a uniting person or a dividing person, or just going to get to that office and forget. Let me just turn the subject matter to another issue.
Well, Michael, if I could just real quickly have just a final comment is, for me, I take my role as a representative of all of the people who live in my district seriously. So that means I've got to serve and help them and try to make everybody's life better. And that means I have to take my role of what I call governing, the idea that we have this large government in different levels, federal, state, and city. We've got to make sure that as best as it possibly can, it works for the people. And I think that isn't a political position. And I know there are political positions where you can say we have differences of opinion of how that government, ought to be working. And I think if I can have those conversations, and I do, I've got them with plenty of my Republican colleagues, about how do we do these things. Those are the productive conversations, and those are the places where we push and pull and come to an agreement that works for everybody. And I just worry, I think I agree with you, that this, we may be getting away from that, because we've gotten away from the idea that, the presidency, my position, any elected position, any governmental position, is one that at the most basic level, the people in it should be saying what's best for
all Americans, all Pennsylvanians, everyone in my district. This is something that's been lacking for a long time. Knowing you personally, I can give you, without any, buttering up or something, I will say that you're a fair guy. When I ask you for something, you do it in behalf of your community and many people way outside of your community, because it's for the benefit of many. Right. Joe, I want to say this to you. As an American worker, we're all American workers. Everyone employed to do a job and support themselves can really feel good about themselves and know that they can enjoy their life and support their family. Now, we're in this country, we lost over 77,000 businesses over the last 35 years. And we have to turn that whole thing around. Through our broadcast and through all of our efforts, we've been doing that. We're now broadcasting with 21 other stations who promote our message, our weekly commentary, because it's a positive message, urging people to go out and buy American. Make sure you look for American. Speak up where you shop so that the people in the stores understand that we are looking out for each other first. Now, in recent years, many foreign countries, without naming the names, have purchased American companies, either kept them here or took them abroad. Many took them abroad. And then there's the opposite side of the coin, where many of the companies took all of their stuff that was made in America and took it overseas to be made. And a lot of people, figured, well, it's the same brand name. It's, what's the difference? I didn't really know. I didn't, understand until I'm hearing more and more about this. We're looking out for the well-being of our workers today. We're looking out for the well-being of our children and our future generations. This is a very important, as a father, you know how important it is that your children have a future. And that's what everyone listening and everyone that's supporting our movement feels. A lot of the social programs that are being addressed in all state capitals are not really addressing jobs and urging people to find ways to get job skills so they can support themselves. I hope that this is going to change more and more in our government, all statewide governments, because this is where we have to have administrations promoting independence, not dependency. As a result of the lack of jobs, many of us see in our travels what is happening with America's young people. by not getting those things in school, things like learning wood shop and all the other good things, heating and air conditioning. It's hard for me to hear from suppliers that say, well, I have to bring in foreign people to help us with our heating and air conditioning situation because we need workers that know what they're doing and we don't have enough American workers. Yet in America, we have 39 million people living in poverty, of which 20 million of those are really working age and able-bodied people that could and should be trained to be in the workforce. I want to introduce you now to somebody who went through some tough times, and 12 years ago, he opened up a store, the Made in America store, and he's done unbelievable work. In fact, last Saturday, he celebrated his 12th anniversary. He's been a longtime member of our committee, Buy American Made, Support American Workers. His name is Mark Andel. Mark, welcome our special guest, Joe Hohenstein.
Yeah, thank you, Mike, and good morning, Rich, and Larkin, and Henry. Thanks for making us sound good. Joe, great to have you on. Great to listen to you guys talk. A lot of good things going on. Harrisburg, PA, my country music singer, Ricky Lee, is from Altoona, but I've spent a bunch of time down in Pennsylvania. But Ricky started music for our vets, so a great, great family down in Altoona. Yeah, Joe, I started the Made in America store 12 years ago. We celebrated 12 years, Mike, like you said, this past Saturday, and I got to tell you, you know, everybody was telling me how bad the weather was going to be all week, and I didn't look at my phone on purpose because people love to tell you the weather, and God showed up again because I got sunburn. And I really did, and we had 1,000-plus people show up. We had three buses, one local, one from Michigan, lower Michigan came, and one from Minnesota. And, yeah, so, Joe, we get buses from around the country. We got one today I just did, and then one coming from Sacramento, California, Friday, so unbelievable. But we had a great day. We had vendors, and you'll recognize Channel Lock. They came, set up a table, and had their new pliers and whatnot. But Channel Lock's got over 350 employees, sixth-generation company in Meadville, Pennsylvania. Yep. And we had 30-plus vendors, Ricky Lee doing the music, food trucks, and we're a home base for Honor Flight, Buffalo Niagara, so we try to get two flights of heroes to Washington every year, Tom Petrie and his team, and we just became a home base for Gold Star Mothers of New York. But we try to do good things. We're up to 10,000 products, support 500 privately owned American businesses, and support entrepreneurs and vendors. But skilled trades, like we touched on, Mike, so important. I was just on the bus today, and they can relate. I'm on six school boards trying to get the metal shops, wood shops back in school and expose our children to them in a younger age, like 6th through 8th grade. And, you know, kids need a purpose, and working with your hands, and they're going to make the money of doctors soon, and it's happening now. Got welders from $30 to $50 to $60 an hour. You know, Joe, it's great to hear what you're doing. You believe, I believe in All Lives Matter. We're not an R or D thing. But I do have one shirt that says Made in America Store on front because China's a long drive to work on the back.
I appreciate the humor on that one, that's for sure. I have seen a bit of what you've done as well, because I do track a bit of what Michael has been doing in his other job. I usually work with Michael on the social service side in Polish American Social Services in Philly, but the work of being able to say, look, we have to support manufacturing. There are a whole bunch of other considerations that make that important and actually make it desirable to be providing the local jobs in local spaces for our workers and supporting domestic companies. And one of the big places that people don't always really think about is the one that's really hit hard, which is supply chain issues. If we have more domestic production, the supply chain isn't held hostage by what occurs in a a far-off city or a plant in China, when I've had these conversations with people who recognize how the Chinese manufacturing sector is set up, many of the smaller businesses that have contracts to do the to do their manufacturing overseas in places like China, they are effectively sitting in line with other customers, and they don't have the individual power to you know, either get good pricing or, more to the point, be able to get their contracts satisfied in a timely way, and you know, with all of the upheaval that was happening you know, throughout the world, and China was as impacted by the pandemic as you know, probably more so than most places. There were specific problems that actually turned out because China had taken a traditional holiday break just before the pandemic hit. And that meant all of those workers who had just left their company towns where they worked were left home in their residential towns. And that was, you know, that in the end, you know, had some of this impact. So in order not to be sort of hostage to some of those things, a domestic supply chain that just, you know, is something that's desirable. And the other things, you know, that actually come into play on that, people don't usually think of it this way either, but the environment and climate change, you know, being able to have a tighter, simpler supply chain that takes fewer steps to complete and uses less energy, uses less resources, is also something that we should be focused on and developing as best as we can. Because if we can, again, do that, and then at the very end is all of the stuff that everybody understands about a domestic supply chain, which is your local and you know, domestic businesses are the ones that prosper, and when that happens, the local and domestic workers are the ones who prosper as well. And you know, I think you know, everybody understands that last bit, but I think some of the other things around how the supply chain impacts both cost of goods and the ability to have the goods in a timely way, and then also this sort of side impact that it has with you know, positive environmental impact, because you're, you know, frankly just moving things you know, at shorter distances. It all of this really comes into play, and I say this as a legislator who is a huge fan of my domestic port in Philadelphia, because it sits in my district, and you know, and I'm going to always be supporting my Philadelphia port and its ability to operate in international trade. But at the same time, I think if there are ways for us to be looking at other domestic sources for goods and services, you know, we've got to be doing that. So
absolutely. I
appreciate the work that you're doing.
Joe is general welding and fabricating, so I've been in business 37 years. Our motto is "You dream it, we build it." So we're a sole source provider for Northrop Grumman for their joint thread emitter system and their JEDI system, and also we do oil and mining. You know, with that being said, you know, the hard thing with this rapid inflation right now, we see in the product shortage and the worker cultural change are our big three that we've got to work on. In 37 years of business, this is the toughest run I've had, especially with diesel at $6.90 or $7. You know, everything drives with diesel. So you're absolutely point on. You know, we've got to do continent of origin is what I met the president of Caterpillar And all these people, we believe in that. Logistically, it makes sense. And we always asked, even Mike, 50-50 fair trade, support the country you live in, and elect qualified, non-selfish political leaders like yourself. So your port, I just want them empty shipping containers going back full with Made in America products.
Yes, that's been, we still haven't had a breakthrough in being able to do that, but I am paying attention to that with almost every report that I'm getting, from the port. It's like, okay, so this is where we're going with containers, because Philadelphia's port is increasing its container load. What are we doing to, like you said, make sure that that we're doing exports along with the imports, because for a port, almost regardless of where the product comes, but I got a predilection for domestic products, but for a port, the jobs that get created at a port have a multiplier effect in other areas of the economy, and that's something that that I'm in tune with, because I intentionally sought out a position on the Transportation Committee precisely because I recognize that this is one of the key areas that we need to be making sure that we're paying attention to, because it only happens if you actually specifically plan it and help to direct it. I think that's where governmental policies can have that positive impact. They can just, they don't have to over-regulate, but they can bend the behavior in particular directions with certain policies.
Joe, I want to add something here that 30 years ago, 25 years ago, and 20 years ago, maybe 22 years ago, I attended an event here in Philadelphia where foreign manufacturers were coming here and telling people, we will be able to handle that product, get it to you as exactly the way it is coming to your stores now from your plant here in Pennsylvania or New Jersey or wherever. And you will have no problems with warehouse issues. It'll just go right from your dock to your customers, and you'll be able to make a lot more money. Well, at one point, that was a fact. And the fact is this, that they were giving the people a less costly item that they could sell. So when they brought the item to America, if the item was worth $1, the company could sell it for $3, which is what it cost when they made it in America. Today, those prices have gone up a lot. The problem we're suffering with is we do not have the businesses here in the United States to pick up the load and start making it again. So bringing back a big number of those industries or recreating them, brand new industries here in the USA, making, it doesn't have to be this particular name or that particular name. It has to be the product. And let's get this on the move because, as I said earlier, we have to get people working. We have to get those job skills up and running. And we have to get the trades and all this back in our schools. 30 years ago, the trades were very important in the schools. Then someone says, well, a lot of that's being made overseas. Maybe we can go less and less and, go to all educational programs and classes. It didn't work. It hurt America. So it was very cleverly done. It's time now to turn the page. We've been talking about this for a number of years. However, now it's really time to turn the page because the ships come in low to the river because they're loaded with cargo, and they leave high up because the containers going back are empty. And with that said, I want to introduce you to another gentleman who's part of our panel, Larkin Conley, who he's worked with SCORE, helping, promote businesses and teach people how to, get involved in businesses. He is a business advocate. Larkin Conley is from Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh area. So, Larkin, welcome our very special guest.
Welcome, Jim. The only thing I can say to you to start this diatribe of mine is go Steelers. Beyond that, so you're in Harrisburg, you're from Philadelphia, so you're either an Eagle fan or you're right on that line of demarcation where you're allowed to be a Steelers fan because you're right in the middle of the state.
The Steelers have always been my AFC team, but now I bleed Eagles green.
I'm glad, but I will
say this: when I was 10 years old and, you know, collected beer cans, because apparently that was what you did in the 70s and 80s, I got a lot of the Iron City beer cans that were made for the you know, commemorating the Super Bowl win. So I do have all of those. You know,
I collected that entire set. And then we lost to Cincinnati, and I drank every one of them. Today is just one of those days where I can't find it in my soul to talk about any subject, even with you, Jim, beyond the shootings in Uvalde, Texas.
Yeah.
That's horrid. It is to me, along with educational deficits and spending deficits, it is what I am sure people in England and Germany and Italy and Poland stand over there and look back and go, that's pathetic. That's absolutely pathetic. And the problem I have with it is the first reaction out of somebody very close to me's mouth was, if only those damn Republicans. And I thought, oh man. To which I gave instructions. I am a dedicated, I'm a party chairman, ward leader. I mean, I've done the whole thing, especially in Philadelphia, where, you know, Alamo, you stood better chances than you do if you're a Republican in Philadelphia. But
right.
It's not a Democrat. It's not a political issue, and I don't understand why politicians all over the world. I don't care if you're a city councilman. I don't care if you're a state senator, state house rep, a governor, a mayor, a congressman, a senator. Why we can't fix this problem is so far beyond me. It's not funny, and the thing is. Then it's come down to lobbyists, and it's come down to who supports the NRA and who doesn't support the NRA. And that usually, to some degree, is a Republican versus Democrat issue, which is fine. So is abortion, as well as it should be. But somewhere, there is a compromise. Somewhere, the Democrats and the Republicans, not as enemies, but as compatriots, as people who are supposed to be, have been elected to solve our problems, can sit down and find a middle ground and get assault weapons off the street. You know, I saw on one of the news channels this morning, Senator Inhofe, the great senator from the state of Oklahoma.
Right.
And his comment to the camera was, oh, I'm just sitting in my office waiting for the, you know, Democrats to turn this into a gun issue. And I thought, so I heard that, and I said, I gotta look this bozo up and see where that came from. Does anybody want to guess how old Senator Inhofe is?
I'm gonna guess 79.
79. Well, you're off by 8 years. The man's 87 years old. With two more years to serve in the Senate. Now, in case anybody hasn't been paying attention, my generation, the baby boomers, have done a great job in completely screwing up this country. Totally screwing up this country. The baby boomers is a generation that has created this mess that we have. And all of them, if they open their mouth or run for an office, to be shot shortly before they register to vote. It's absolutely absurd. And the guy, James Lankford, you know, I thought, well, I'm going to look up Oklahoma. Here's a guy that is coming up on his run as the state, as the senator from the fine state of Oklahoma. He's raised $5,381,000. He's only spent on this run he's in $3,079,000. He's got cash on hand as a senator. He has $2.9 million cash on hand.
Yep.
You know what? Yeah. Okay. So I'm gonna, let me get down because, Jim, I really want to hear what you have to say.
Okay.
It's too bad that the Republicans and the Democrats can't get together and stop this. And by the way, before you give me your answer to how do you think this ought to be fixed, I want to tell you that my wife has taken me off entrepreneurial restriction and has allowed me to start a new company, and I am going to manufacture howitzers and tanks, both equipped with air with ground-to-air missiles, and I'm going to sell them to hunters. Because, you know, it takes a weapon that big to bring down a deer.
Mm. Well, and that you, but see what you just said is part. It's one of the elements of the issue, which is one of my Northeast Philadelphia colleagues, Ed Nielsen, is fond of the comment when he's talking about this with some of our Republican legislators who, you know, often are rural, and they said, your guns are for hunting animals and food. Our guns in the city tend to be for hunting people. And I think recognizing that difference and recognizing the a group like the NRA used to be a gun safety organization as well. And I think the thing I've tried to do when I talk about this stuff, you know, publicly, is the recognition that no single right under the Constitution, his Second Amendment in particular in this space, should always supersede other rights. And right now, you've got the rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which even if it might not technically be a right in the U.S. Constitution, it's, you know, it's there. It's also a right that's delineated specifically in a lot of state constitutions. But the impact that the exercise of the right to bear arms without restriction has on other people's rights, and then that goes to what I was talking about before, the idea of governing for everybody's benefit as best as we can. And that means that in this balancing act between individual rights and community rights and everything else, not everybody gets 100% all the time. And in the plain language of the Second Amendment, the concept of well-regulated militias, you know, has that idea that the right to bear arms is not an unrestricted individual right. It's actually something that more adheres to a communal right, not to be subject to unreasonable restriction. But and for that reason, I would say legislatively, yes, there's a whole lot of laws that are out there that are being blocked, and to a degree it becomes partisan because the NRA has made bigger inroads into the Republican Party on these issues, but it's not strictly partisan. I think it really is focused on the idea that the NRA went from being a gun safety organization to one that's more focused and funded by manufacturers of of firearms that don't want the restrictions as much for commercial reasons as for social reasons. But the other problem that we have is we can make all the laws that we want, and if we don't come back to some of these social ideas of there are times when I personally have to accept some limitations on what I want to do or what I feel is my right in order for somebody else to get some enjoyment of their life, liberty, and happiness. And that we have to trust in a government to come to at least a reasonable balancing act on that. That's a social thing that we're not there right now to be able to have that conversation, because we're not even at the point where we're talking about it being legislative or law based either. So we've got to have both conversations if we're actually going to really make it change, because it does have to be something where people at large in the society recognize that a specific set of laws and rules make sense, so that we're not in this constant conflict between, either 100% yes or 100% no, and that's not where we are. And I can't. That's not where we're going to end up.
So Jim,
we have
Jim,
Joe Hohenstein.
How do we get there, Jim? How do we get there? What do we do?
I think one, we recognize that some of the messages behind the unrestricted use of firearms in particular is coming less from a civil liberty or social or liberty type of standpoint, which is how it's been sold, and more as something that actually benefits a particular set of people with a lot of money to put into the political races.
But Joseph, I would like to just say this to you. There a lot of what we're seeing with these people coming and going overboard, killing others and all, a lot of it's because we don't have enough jobs for them. People have a lot of time on their hands, but they're becoming radicalized by what they see on the internet and all. There's a lot of things that we have to change to get love to back to where it should be and where it was, so that these types of people will feel better about themselves. And if you feel better about yourself, you'll automatically want to love the next person because you have a skill. You're somebody special. Mm-hmm. But when you don't have those skills, this is where a lot of the problems come in. When I talk with some people, they say, "Oh, Michael, I feel virtually worthless. I have nothing going on for me." And to hear that from a young person who went to school, graduated from high school, and yet really had no access and was never even asked, "What would you like to do when you graduate from school?" It was just too many other issues on the table. And, through our agency and all, we try to make people feel good about themselves. And that's what it is. Joseph Hohenstein, you are the very best.
I'm going to say something. One more comment. Jim, this is what happens. We start relating our problems to an actual problem, and yet we don't fix the actual problem.
Right.
That's what's wrong with this country. We take everything back to me, 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 me. If everybody had jobs, we wouldn't have these kind of events. I'm sorry, there's not a swinging whatever in the country that would support get everybody back to work and we won't have mass shootings anymore.
Well, you may have some, but you will have less people sitting on the internet looking for ways to cause problems, because they right now every one of the people that has been causing problems, when you look at their history, They have no jobs and no job skills. They were sitting around too much looking at ways to be radicalized, not even realizing that this was happening to them, and they then decided to take action. Now, Rich Logis has a question for our great guest, Joseph Hohenstein.
Joe, thanks again. And I guess this will warrant a further discussion, but I think I can sum up in a relatively easy to understand way what the actual firearm, regulation stalemate is. And that stalemate is that Republicans in Congress, we'll stick there for a moment, are petrified that more firearm regulation will actually reduce gun-related deaths, suicides, and injuries. Mm-hmm. I think the Democrats also, Joe, are a little afraid that some of what they want to propose may not work either. So if I were advising Republicans in Congress, what I would tell them is, vote with the Democrats on more regulation. If they work, you get to say you supported a working policy. If they don't work, you then get to say, I told you so.
Right.
So at the end, that's really the stalemate. And I consider myself a little bit more than an amateur, knowledgeable person on this issue. So if the Democrats truly feel, if they truly have the confidence that their policies will work, abolish the filibuster and do it. Which, to be clear, Joe, I'm ambivalent about abolishing the filibuster, even though senatorial norms have been totally changed by Harry Reid, rest in peace, and Mitch McConnell. But if the Democrats feel that strongly about it, they're that confident, abolish the filibuster and pass the laws.
Abolish it. I'd like to make my closing remark. Blah,
sure.
Blah,
thanks,
blah,
Joe.
Blah, 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 blah.
Abolish the filibuster. Go abolish it. Go abolish
Mark,
it and pass the law.
Your final.
I think it is a time.
F a walk, as Alec Baldwin said, and Glengarry Glenn Ross, F a walk. Abolish the filibuster, pass the law.
Right. I hear you.
Once again, I'd like to say a special thank you to our guest, a good friend,
and of course,
someone who has done great work in his district in the Philadelphia area, and also someone who has been responsive to our requests for help and has helped us to with clients and other individuals as needed. Joseph Hohenstein, you're the best. And
Thank you, Michael. All
I can tell you is do your thing. I know you're going back to the session. What time is session today?
We were in the middle of it, but it's the preliminary round where we don't decide anything. I'll be going back in about an hour.
Well, good luck.
Yeah.
God bless. Remember, we need you. We love you. And that's no bull, because you know how many times I can call for different things.
Yes,
and,
I do.
As I call you, people call me. So it all works out well. Ladies and gentlemen, until this Saturday at 11 or next Wednesday at 11, I thank all of you for tuning in. We'll have a rebroadcast of today's program up on the internet today in about 2 hours. Do spread it around. We'll email it out to family and friends and supporters. And do spread the word. American workers need you. They need all of us working together as one. Have a great one. Have a great Memorial Day. God bless.
You too. Thanks,
everyone,
for being on our show, Joe.